You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
First of all, thanks for the invite. Actually, it's good also to see that there's some mutual interest and that we're working together, also with the European Internet Foundation, so I'm very, very happy to be here. I think the Ask You Anything format is fantastic, so I will just briefly try to introduce something without going too much into details of regulation we're dealing with at the moment, which is, I believe, also a mutual interest. We're working on the data protection regulation. It's sort of the now updating the directive we have so far. So, I mean, I will keep sort of away from details in that area because you might have some questions about others. So before I discuss about the right to be forgotten, privacy by design, questions about explicit consent, and so on, again, I'm going to leave this up if this is an area of interest to you. But mainly because privacy and data protection somehow seems to be perceived differently on either side of the Atlantic, which actually I don't believe is really true. But to explain where we're coming from is that when we work on these issues like data protection and privacy, we do know that the regulation we're drafting at the moment will have a huge impact on economies, on businesses, not only operating in the online environment where an Internet Foundation might have a natural interest in, but it will affect financial industries, healthcare industries, insurances. It will actually affect anybody dealing with citizens' data. And if we talk about the Internet and what you can do there with data, I think, okay, naturally, being governor of the European Internet Foundation, you don't have to convince me that the Internet has fantastic opportunities. That when we have the World Wide Web and we can work jointly together when we discuss about mass data accumulation, dealing with issues like the Human Genome Project or others, we can seriously have a beneficial approach for our societies. We can do better in the world, I think, if we combine the forces we have. And I think this is something which might be perceived even in the same way on both sides of the Atlantic. But then again, we have figured out also in legislation it's very, very difficult to somehow transport our message related to privacy in the U.S. First of all, very, very frankly, it's difficult for us as legislators to discuss with our counterparts. You might be aware congressmen and congresswomen are limited in time, constant campaigning, constant fundraising, constantly focused on their constituency. So it is very difficult for us to explain them where the interest we both might have on both sides of the Atlantic, think about our economies, why it would make sense to bond together. We have, when justifying the European Union, for example, in Germany, the narrative that we are trying to explain that even though a country like Germany, the biggest one in the European Union, the third largest economy of the world, the lowest unemployment rate in Europe, we are too small to survive alone. We will not manage a global competition on our own. We need partners we can work together with. We need not only European allies, we need global allies. And maybe the day will come, one day, where also in the United States there will be a recognition that cooperation is a key to success, that no country in a globalized world will be able to stand alone if you have competitors rising up like China, like India, like Brazil. So it is important that one is able to join forces there because especially regions like China or India, having a population of around 1 billion people, they will set standards because they can do so just by their markets. And if we're not able to compete on those matters, if we don't agree, they might just approach us in a divide and conquer manner. And this is something we probably cannot afford. But coming back to privacy, because there's often the misunderstanding that we, in Europe, let's say, are sometimes a little bit paranoid on these issues. And we're a little bit worried how data might be used or abused. I think we have a different story in mind when we talk about privacy, and this is important, at least for me, to get this point also expressed. It is probably in our collective European memory that we deal different with privacy. Most of our countries have been subject to dictatorial regimes, to oppressions, the eastern ones by the Soviets. In Portugal, you had a regime. In Spain, you had Franco. In Germany, you had Nazi Germany. And in Italy, for example, you had Mussolini. All of these regimes have used available data against their own citizens, against their citizens and societies to suppress them, to filter out those who are opposition, to kill those who were against these regimes. And that is maybe why there's a very, very high sensitivity. What happens with citizens' data when it's out there somewhere? Who will use it? Will it only be used for the good? Is it maybe something which possibly can be turned against you? Is it something which we see now in countries where we had the Arab Spring or ongoing revolutions? For example, if we look at Syria, where the internet is cut down, where in other Arab countries data has been used against opposition and citizens, still is if you look at countries like Iran. But as Europeans, we wouldn't even have to look so far. If you look at Belarus, the last existing dictatorship in Europe, again there, data will be used against opposition, against your own citizens. And fortunately, this is an experience you never had to go through. At least as a country, as a state, the United States had always, even if there might be a different internal perspective, governments who were working for the people and not against them. And I think this is something, when we discuss data privacy, it explains in a little way why we have, how would you say, a different perspective towards it, and sometimes might even be considered paranoid. But I think I'll leave it at that one, because it was said a short comment, short introduction, so the Q&A is actually the more interesting part, also for me.
May I ask the first question? And this announcement might be like 10 minutes late. I'm recording this, and we're going to publish the MP3 afterwards, if that's okay. And this is, we have folks from a variety of different spaces in the press, so this is pretty much on the record, so just as a disclosure.
Yeah.
Commenting on your comment about privacy, Europeans have a sensitivity to to data, collection of data, and to have it be used against them. However, I'd point out, I wanted your thoughts on this, is that the European Union has a data retention mandate.
Yeah.
Telecoms need to retain data for a period of time, and that differs from state to state. It's part of a directive. It's different in Spain than it is in Italy. The United States has no such government data retention directive for private enterprise. How do you square that, the paranoia, as you said, with the fact that you actually affirmatively require companies to retain data, whereas the United States doesn't?
Well, you can square it. It's wrong, actually. That is the point. We have now the Data Retention Directive in place since 2006. And, at least four countries of the European Union has been contested in front of constitutional high courts. And it has been considered as a violation either of fundamental rights or of other civil liberties. So there is no, at least in my point of view, there is no justification. Probably if you would talk to law enforcement, it would be different. But when drafting this whole directive, we've been discussing to law enforcement, we've been discussing to police officers how much of a use it actually is. And most of them have told us, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. If you retain data of 500 million citizens, how do you expect us to find what we actually are looking for? What we would need as law enforcement is accurate sort of build-up data where we can actually pin down what we're looking for. So I think you can boil it down that there was a political will to do so. And I remember that in 2005 when the whole discussion started, we had the tragic bombings in London. And that was also the time when the UK had the presidency of the European Union at that time. And it was one of the clear and outspoken goals of the UK presidency at that time to have this data retention directive because it could give the appearance or could give the idea that one is doing something to fight terrorism. And regardless if it is necessary, effective or not, I might be biased concerning this issue because I was actually the rapporteur. I was a sponsor of the bill. I withdrew my name when it was voted in plenary because the result I did not agree at all with. So there was no judicial or legal effect. It just was a political signal that I'm not willing to give my name for such a bill. And in the aftermath, it has actually been proven that it has not raised an effectiveness in terms of the fight against crime or terrorism. So I believe the political will to somehow prove one is doing something overruled all, sense.
Hi, Laura Ballard, U.S. State Department. I recently read your paper on life cycle data protection management, and what struck me is how similar it is to other ideas about accountability that we've explored at our end, and particularly the framework of accountability that's been developed as part of the APEC cross-border privacy rules. And there has been some dialogue between the Article 29 Working Party and the APEC folks on exploring interoperability between that system and the EU system of binding corporate rules. I think if you're looking for a way to incentivize companies to adopt these sort of comprehensive management programs, if you ask them what they want is access to particular marketplaces. And so, you know, the APEC framework and the European framework, they kind of need each other in a way. And so one of the things that we suggested is ways to improve the sort of interoperability and get the conversation going is we actually filed a submission with the Council of Europe in June encouraging ways to look at interoperability between the APEC CBPR and Convention 108 more broadly. And what we found, this is most recently, I just got back from Strasbourg on Saturday, is that the European Commission doesn't seem particularly inclined to entertain these ideas and has insisted on a provision that basically allows EU member states to exempt themselves from the general obligation under Convention 108 to ensure free data flow among the member states. And so what they've done is basically reduced the attractiveness of Convention 108 for any non-European country to ever join. I mean, at this point, it would be easier to just go get advocacy than to use Convention 108. And so I just wonder, I mean, if this, these are ideas that you're intrigued by and want to explore, do you see it as a problem that the Commission is basically able to use, in the case of the COE, a sort of superior voting position to sort of set all the rules and set the terms of debate and rule out things as just simply flatly unacceptable?
Well, I wouldn't consider it a problem, rather a nuisance. It is a little bit annoying sometimes that the Commission does go ahead without actually verifying or consulting, maybe problem to counsel if this is something which would be in line with the politics we would subscribe to. But it highlights also the complexity of the European Union, because the Council of Europe itself is actually not part of the European Union.
They kind of are now.
but it's not one of the official institutions where we have the Commission, the Council, and the European Parliament again, and then the Council of Europe. So where we have more than 40 states which are a member of it. And the official institutions of the European Union are the three, which again, Council, Commission, and Parliament. The Convention 108, as you might know when you're coming back from Strasbourg, is also in redrafting at the moment. So they're trying to redesign that one. We were trying, at least as Parliament, to cooperate with the Council of Europe to find a common approach. Obviously, that has been stuck, and it's not working the way we would like to. But again, the legislative bodies are the Council and the European Parliament.
Right.
So the Commission is invited to give their input and to comment and to defend their proposal. But within the actual drafting process, they do not really have a say in terms of legal say. They are outspoken and they have an influence. But if Parliament decides to follow, and actually, by the way, thank you for reading the paper 1 and 2. If Parliament would agree to follow the ideas we stated, well, then the Commission actually is powerless to counter that. I mean, they will try.
Right. No, but I mean, honestly, I wouldn't agree that it's stuck. It's actually moving forward. It will move forward to the Commission specifications.
No, I mean, together with Parliament, the discussions. The Council of Europe and Parliament. There, the discussions are happening.
Right. No, but I mean, as far as I can tell, the TPD's the committee has wound up its work. The modernization will go forward to the Commission specifications, and the Commission has made clear that nothing else is going to happen that it either procedurally upsets the numbers advantage they have. I mean, you've got 27 out of the 44 votes there. They've made clear that there's not going to be anything on the agenda that the EU doesn't effectively control.
Well, I would say let's see, because now imagine that the Parliament and the Council and therefore the European Union would follow my approach and supported by colleagues, it would be quite awkward then if the Commission would actually argue against the position we've been taking in terms of in front of the Council of Europe. So, of course, the European Commission is, again, especially in how would you say, in person of Mrs. Reding, very strong and very outspoken, and she has a tremendous track record of 100% success. But I am not sure if it will work out this way, this time, this way. So, again, I mean, we as a Parliament wanted to discuss with the Council of Europe to come to sort of a streamlining. Obviously, now the Commission is sort of bypassing this procedure, as you described, and putting their point of view on it. But again, when we vote on it, and that will be probably before summer next year, was in the Parliament, I would be surprised to see the Council of Europe take a complete different position than the European Union itself. So it's a little bit wait and see on this issue, but again, I would be surprised to see a complete contradictory approach or a different approach.
No, I don't think there was ever going to be a complete contradictory approach, but to exempt the EU from the free flow of data obligations in Convention 108, again, it just completely obviates the need for Convention 108 from a non-European.
And it undermines also the legitimacy of the Council of Europe in a way as well.
Exactly.
So.
Laura's question reminds me that we should have spent about 10 hours explaining how the European Union Commission works, but we don't have the 10 hours.
No,
I'm sorry.
We did this in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Dave Burr from Pierce Government IT. Wonder if you can go ahead and address the freedom of expression implications of the right to be forgotten.
Well, first of all, I would dare to say that the right to be forgotten is not there to stay. It is an interesting idea, which I'm not too sure on what basis it was actually founded, because data protection rules already allow you or give you a right to deletion of your data. So the right to be forgotten, as stated in Article 17.2 of the draft, basically sort of enhances or sort of boosts this right of deletion by burdening on third parties that data they have passed on, they have to make sure on behalf of the individual is deleted. And I don't think that this is a sensible approach, and I don't see too much support in Parliament for it. I do, of course, see some colleagues who say, well, if we scrap it, we have to come up with an alternative somehow, because maybe not the political correct term, but it's the baby of the Commission, this right to be forgotten. And you always have to be careful when you touch somebody else's children. So the freedom of expression can actually never, how would you say, be limited, at least the way we understand it, by the right to be forgotten. Because I do not see, first of all, the regulation itself has an article stating the role of the freedom of expression in this whole regulatory process. But at the same time, I would not see how it is possible, for example, if I now dare accidentally, on purpose, whatever, say something seriously stupid, and you publish it, by what means could I go and say, please delete it, or please take this out of your archives? I do not see that this somehow would also go in line with maybe the right people have to be informed and these questions. So I think if at all something survives like a right to be forgotten, then I think it has to be limited to the point where we're talking about judicially clearly examined, I would just say, illegal violations of rights of personnel or something. I don't know if that's a correct English term. But, for example, we have cases now. Now, one example, you might be aware of Mr. Max Mosley. He was head of the FIA, the Federal, I think, International Automobile Organization. He was caught in some not too good situations in London hotel rooms. And so basically, but he successfully sued, actually, newspapers that these pictures would be published, continuously published. I think in Germany and France he was successful. I'm not sure about the UK. But if there's something where court obviously has sentenced that it is illegal to continue to publish, then somehow it has to be enforced, because this is then the question of the personal right which an individual has. But I would not see that the right to be forgotten could be extended. For example, if you write anything now, I'm not happy about it. I mean, that's how life goes. How can I actually go ahead and then tell a newspaper, please stop publishing this? The European Union is not a banana republic and will not become one by the right to be forgotten. For sure.
Can you tweet something embarrassing?
Well, I am, how would you say? Well, my life. I mean, problematic, but again, I'm an adult.
If you're a politician and you say tweets of an embarrassing picture of your anatomy.
Yeah, and it's related to your name. Then it's probably a stupid thing to do. But by what?
Could you,
no,
under the right to be forgotten, have that deleted? It is very personal.
Good question. Well, the question is it covered by the freedom of expression of somebody else?
Is it?
Quite possible.
I don't know.
I'm your political opponent.
Good, Good question, I must admit. I don't know. We don't have this stuff over in the
I mean, I could give you another.
No, so I must admit, I'm not too sure. Well, it is my personal data. I mean, I put it forward, but I don't see, I don't see a reason why we should create a law which basically would give you the right, I mean, to delete that. I don't know. I mean, because, well, it's stupid behavior, but you're an adult, and you should, in a way, be knowing what you're doing, at a certain point, at least, even if it's tempting. I don't know. I don't see a justification to create a right to do that, because, I mean, would it in consequence mean that you wouldn't have to think before you act? Because you just could take it off? I don't want to support, actually, this sort of philosophy.
What's the difference between that and getting caught in a hotel room doing bad stuff? What's the distinction? Where's the line?
Well, probably it's for a court to decide, because if we had a court deciding that Mr. Mosley's pictures are not to be, on whatever grounds, I didn't read the ruling, are to be published, well, he has a case. I mean, it's the same, if, for example, I can also... what you can also do, I don't know, I must admit, I'm not familiar with U.S. rules, but for example, I can defend myself against insults or insultory comments in public as well. So, of course, you are allowed to publish that you're not happy with my work, but you can't call me, for example, that guy, yeah, or whatever. I mean, so that is where I can also say, well, this is not the way you can address me, even though I'm a public figure. And I think the line is there where court actually states this is a violation in, how would you say, in putting one right against the other. At a certain point, we'll have to define which one overweighs now. And if the court says, well, in this case, it's that one, I think it's at least for in where you have the rule of law, I think that's the most objective way to look at things if courts take their decision.
Sure. You addressed this briefly. Alex Byers with Politico. You addressed this briefly when you were speaking earlier. But in terms of the importance of privacy or really what it entails, what do you see as differences between the U.S. And Europe? Is the U.S. Behind the times in a sense when it comes to an urgency within society or government to protect consumers' data or what can be done with it?
Good question. I mean, I know that you have the Consumer Data Protection Bill somewhere still floating around, and I don't know at what stage it is at the moment in terms of the legislative process. So I do believe that there's also a very high interest here in the protection of data. We do have different concepts, though. I mean, for example, you would not necessarily have the concept of, or please correct me if I'm wrong, of data protection officers as we know them, like that they're independent authorities, that they people can address them, requesting guidance in certain areas, that they have certain rights also to put fines on companies or others. So that, but therefore, on the other hand, you have a very, very strong and engaged civil society on these questions, which we, due to maybe because we have this official construction, do not have that way. So I think the value of personal data and privacy is as high in the United States, at least when it comes to citizens, as it is in Europe. But we have different concepts of dealing with it, maybe also arising in the fact that, and then again, correct me if I'm wrong, in the European Union, based on the law we have, I never lose ownership of my personal data, wherever it is. I don't care if an online company has it, if a government has it, it's mine. Where else, as I've understood, right, once you've given personal data to a private entity or a company here, basically they can, to a certain extent, do what they want with it. And that is a very difference in concept as well. So that might be some points, but in terms of the importance, I believe both of our societies are quite aware of the value and the impact infringement of personal data can have. And factually, we see governments on both sides of the Atlantic trying to somehow get access to people's data, and then be it just via Twitter accounts or be it, as you mentioned, data retention issues for law enforcement. So at the end, I don't think we're too different. We just have a different way, as we say in Europe, I mean, there, or you would say maybe there are a lot of ways to get to Rome.
Do you think there's a sense that perhaps if there's sort of a lowest common denominator when it comes to what the rules are? If we look, for example, at Google, Article 29 made news in October about Google's privacy policy, and there was a sense, I think, that you know, if Europe were to impose these regulations on Google, would it really have one privacy policy for users in Europe and then another privacy policy for users in America? Or would it just say, okay, we'll use, to because it's perhaps easier for everyone involved, we will abide by the European regulations in America?
Well, maybe you should ask Eric Schmidt that question.
I
must admit, I do not know how a company like Google would react. I mean, it is certainly would be a bureaucratic burden if they want to apply different privacy policies, and I would wonder how you distinguish them. Suddenly, if, I don't know, if the way would be then it's identified by IP address, it's suddenly a different privacy policy appeals, if I would be Google, I would have one global privacy policy, and if I would apply the highest standards. But again, I'm not Google.
Justin from the Center for Democracy and Technology, you gave a very frank answer on where you've gotten that. I appreciate that. Can you talk about what other parts in the data protection regulation you think are most controversial and most likely to change as the legislative process moves forward?
Well, certainly the question about explicit consent will be in discussion, because one point is, does it always fit actually reality that you have explicit consent? Could one think about concepts where, in special cases, implicit consent to the processing of data can be given? For example, in very obvious cases, which comes to my mind then, and if you, for example, download an application which is designed to tell you what shop is around you, obviously geolocation data is being processed. So would there be an explicit consent necessary to do that? But, for example, if the processing would go beyond that purpose, for example, would be passed on to third parties saying, look, this guy actually is here, maybe you want to inform him or whatever, then there you could think about, then you have this graduated response of explicit consent. But, I mean, what we will have to discuss about is, for example, there's an article dealing with data portability. Does this make sense the way it is designed, or will we just have to specify that actually what is already an existing rule is just confirmed in terms of the data I give to a company, I get back? Because if you think about data portability and in a format that can be transferred and so on, because if you think about, for example, issues like customer care cards or whatever, if I would ask sort of all the data also, which is sort of additionally aggregated back, then I would, how would you say, first of all, I would receive an added value on my data, and then if I would pass it on to for example, a competitor in terms of the customer care cards, they would benefit actually from the work somebody else has done. So that is a point. What I would like to see when we talk about transparency and information, the Commission has not really clarified how they see that. But we've been working on, and you would find that in this article, if we could simplify information in terms, for example, of icons, having sort of a minimum set of six where you say, okay, this is an icon showing that no information beyond the necessary is processed, no information is sold, the information we have on you is encrypted, and things like these that sort of at the first spot people see what's actually happening to their data, and if they're interested in more, they can sort of click on one of the icons and it work like a hyperlink or whatever, and you would be thrown into the 30-page, 10-point data privacy policy and the necessary section there. So think about these issues. What we have to talk about and to define is a question of privacy by design, privacy by default. What does this actually mean? Because the Commission didn't give us a legal definition. But rather focused, or how would you say, said it's going to be all dealt with in a delegated act, namely giving them the power to decide. And there we are quite sensitive to the problem where we say, well, legal definitions, you leave up to the legislator, and not to the executive. So this doesn't... And we will have to discuss about questions, for example, when we talk about sanctions. Is it necessarily the right approach to threaten sanctions in height of 2% of the yearly turnover? Or could one think about graduated responses in terms of sanctions? Could we even consider something like, some might call it cynically, but positive sanctions, like that we increase the number of unnotified audits on a company, for example, that data protection officers could come in without notice, check, as a beginning, and then if we see repeated violations, that you then could start taking out the sledgehammer. But also the questions of, is there negligence, intent when it comes to violations, or how do we deal with a situation that actually a company has a data breach, and it did everything perfect, but the software managing the data had a malfunction. Are they liable for this situation? Who would then be liable? And third, sort of these issues. God, there's so much more because it's a really huge regulation. Actually, our ideas, and that is reflected in this article, is that we introduce a principle of context, because one-size-fits-all approach probably won't work. I said this morning in a meeting, now imagine if just my name, my address, and not even my telephone number, but just these two data sets, if some sort of newspaper loses their subscribers list and this pops out that I'm there, I might not be too worried. I might not care if people know I'm reading, I don't know, the FT, the Wall Street Journal, or whatever. But if the same data, my name and my address, is somehow popped out of, hypothetically, for example, Dr. Ruda's cancer treatment, I might not want everybody to know that I'm in cancer treatment or something like that. So they're the exact same data, just has a very, very different impact on the individual. And that's why I believe we should introduce something which we would call a context principle throughout the whole regulation, and then discussing issues like risk and harm-based approach. Do data leaks, is it likely that they have an adverse effect on the individual in terms of social harm, reputational, financial harm, these issues? But this is sort of, didn't want to extend it, but these are some points we're working on.
You had mentioned that, you know, in the context of having, you know, multiple privacy policies, let's say one privacy policy for data collection in the United States, and then one principle for collection in Europe, that generally you probably want to just have one global privacy policy. And typically, from my understanding, that's how most multinational companies work, U.S.-based companies, is what they do is they have one consistent data privacy policy to accommodate all the different jurisdictions they're in. And that is why you're back in the 1990s when the Commission passed the Data Directive. The Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Commerce got together and created this kind of safe harbor for U.S. companies exchanging data with Europe. So in a way, it's a way to achieve a certain level of adequacy. My understanding is that basically you just like companies default to kind of European standard privacy collection because of the safe harbor. Now, we had, when you were updating the Commission is updating their regulation, we had Francois Labai come and brief in the Rayburn Building, brief congressional staff on the legislation. And the idea is that we were subtly trying to say that generally U.S. companies comply with whatever the Europe regulation is in some way, shape, or form. And in a way, Europe is driving data privacy because of those regulations and will continue to do so unless the United States Congress, which is the active body here, create some kind of baseline online privacy regulation that would achieve a certain level of adequacy. Mm. When you're talking to members of Congress, like you just came down from the Hill, and we're talking with members of Congress, do you think they get the sense that Europe is in the driver's seat when it comes to at least transatlantic data flows and privacy regimes? Do they understand that if they don't act, that Europe will continue to dictate what the privacy regime will be?
Well, that's an unfair question. to be very frank here, and I'm aware that there's publishers around, but sometimes it is difficult to explain to the Congress the complexity of the European Union, and it is even more difficult to have the time, not on our side, to actually meet our legislative counterparts. In 8 years and more than 10 visits to the United States, we were able to organize meetings with two congressmen, two senators. I do understand that they have a very different schedule. Every 2 years, re-election, at least in Congress, constantly considering the constituency and fundraising. So it makes it very, very difficult for us to get through with issues and topics and to raise awareness and to discuss about it. And I sometimes wonder why, because what you pointed out is something we don't want to do. We want to, of course, implement our ideas and visions, how these things work, but we know we're not alone on this planet. And we know that we need friends to cooperate, to do economy with, and to have exchange with. But it's very difficult if friendship in terms of discussions is a one-way street. So we actually do not know necessarily if Congress is at all aware of what we're doing. And we have very, very good exchange, also personally with the White House, on these issues in May this year. And we were thinking about other certain areas where we can define common denominators and streamline actually our legislation, because we do not see that we will have, as desirable as it is, a global agreement on data protection. But it would make sense if in transatlantic relations we would speak the same language when we talk about these issues in mutual benefit of the interests of mutual benefit for our citizens and our industries. But my counterpart or my discussion partner in the White House has unfortunately left, and I'm waiting for a successor who that might be. So that's why I said our discussions are a little bit blocked there. And again, we would like and we need to exchange with our counter-legislators, actually with Congress, but we also have, how would you say, identified that we are not the necessary center of interest, which I can understand, but it makes it very difficult to exchange views, to be polite.
Michael Carney, State Department. Technology obviously is attracting a younger and younger consumer. To what degree do maybe the Europeans do a better job of protecting children's data, that lessons could be learned from the U.S. side, or vice versa?
I'm not too sure if we actually do it better. And it would be, I think, very arrogant to say that we are doing it. So I think what we're trying to do, but it's a long, long journey, is not necessarily to focus only on data protection, but we're doing a lot in terms of awareness raising to actually try to educate in media competence, that they understand in what environment they're moving, that the Internet is not some sort of, I don't know, vacuum, but that, I mean, that what your parents teach you how to watch out when you're on the streets, when strangers talk to you, that this is actually something which is also going on the Internet, and that the same rules somehow apply. But at the same time, of course, you cannot 100% and I think you shouldn't, control kids in every action they're doing. So at the same time, we're trying to educate the parents how they can use actually technology to ensure that children, for example, don't step into these dark traps of the Internet, and then that they understand that parents also, it might sound a little bit banal, but that they talk to their children, that there's an exchange of what's going on, that there's an area of confidence. And I know it sounds all very, very soft, but I think that's the beginning, because you can't just legislate that kids shall not enter chat rooms and talk to strangers. This will not happen. So I must admit, I don't know how in the U.S., in terms of data protection, I must admit the Commission unfortunately has copied something when it comes to children, which has proven to be working difficultly in the United States when we have a passage in the regulation dealing with that parents or custodians shall give consent when children are entering the Internet, and so on. I believe you have your experience here, and I think the result of that experience is COPPA, because seeing that it actually did not work that way. So I was surprised to see the Commission actually copy something which didn't work. And there we have also a very good context. Also we see FTC, who is a very, for us at least, a good body giving us input how one deals with this situation. So I must admit, again, I would not dare to have the arrogance to say we're doing it better.
I guess my question, yeah. You know, you have a lot of pre-applications now, especially for four-year-olds.
adult?
4 years old.
Really?
Well, children.
I don't have kids yet. I don't know.
A child can now navigate on the internet before he or she can tie his or her shoe.
Wow.
So you have children who, I have a 4 year old who, actually, a 6 year old, a 7 year old, the technology comes very easily to them. You have a plethora of now free applications. Free applications don't require a credit card, nothing to showcase that you truly are an adult. So I know that this is the future. I have to believe that Europe is going to be facing, if not already, a similar type of dynamic, where you do have data that's being derived from someone who's receiving something freely, but it's implicit that when I get a free application, I have to get something in exchange. Well, many times the exchange is data, correct? So to what degree is Europe, I guess, looking at that and saying, well, is this data from a child versus this is someone who truly, more than just implied consent, is someone who actually truly directly knows what he or she's doing.
Yeah.
It's more curiosity if Europe is looking at these questions, and if so, what lessons maybe can we learn from the U.S. side or vice versa from the European side?
Oh, well, we are looking at these questions. That's why I tried to point out that in the regulation you have actually this idea, which was, or it still is, I believe, U.S. law, but that's what I meant. Unfortunately, we sort of took what has been proven to cause difficulties. So there was obviously a lack of creativity in the commission to come up with an own idea. And that will be our task now, basically, of legislators to figure out what to do. So I must admit, just to give it back, I'm happy for any input to help deal with that situation because, as you rightly point out, I mean, there's nothing such as a free lunch. And if kids engage on the net, well, again, it might sound very, very soft, but it's a question of parents and education as well. I mean, it's very easy to say the government shall do it, there shall be legislation dealing with it. This all will not help if one doesn't sit together at home and somehow just, I mean, probably you and your kids, I mean, when they're around, you will go like, okay, don't do this or this is that, and you will watch what they're doing also because you're a curious and interested father and you want to see how it develops and all this stuff. And I could just imagine if I would have kids, I would probably be hanging out with them when they're surfing or of course, you cannot control them 24/7, but I think as an example, I mean, you will never avoid that kids, and this is, again, from a theoretical point, you will never avoid that kids do stuff you might not want if they try a spliff or whatever. I mean, but I think if they have a solid background, if they have a stable social environment, if they feel that there's trust and confidence at home, I don't think that one would have to be too worried. I mean, probably our parents were freaking out when we were playing outside and coming home with bloody knees and wondering what we've been doing. And again, they let us out in the world without being controlled 24/7 because we were educated, I believe, at least in a way I can speak for myself, to understand a little bit what's sensible. And of course, you test your boundaries. And kids will do that on the internet now as well. So, but again, in terms of regulation, I'm happy for any good idea. because I don't think that, for example, something like a concept like implicit consent can actually work with kids. Because you have to understand the whole situation to be able to implicitly actually give a consent. And you wouldn't find that in civil law as well, that kids can give implicit consent. In most European countries, kids can even engage into contracts until they're the age of 16 minimum. So, sorry, it's probably not a super satisfying answer because I can't give you the legal terms, but I would be a parent. I would probably, even in these issues anyway, not rely on a government, but in my parental educational skills.
Greg Miljanek, Senator for Democracy and Technology. Senate committee just passed out a bill that requires warrants for email and other content that people store online. How does U.S. lawful access law compare to that in Europe? Are we doing better? Are we not doing as well?
I didn't understand the beginning. What was passed?
A bill came out of a key committee requiring warrants for email and other content that you store online.
How is
called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act.
How is it supposed to look like? I mean,
before government can get your email online, you can go to court and get a court order to turn over.
Oh, good, that's it.
General Petraeus would have wanted this.
Well, it's my communication. I mean, a government can't come to my letterbox and take out my letters, actually. I mean, where would be the difference? I mean, nobody can come home and say, look, please give us your private post. Why should they be able to do that without a warrant and emails?
I guess my question is, in Europe, is that the rule, that you always have to go to court and get a court order?
Yeah, for sure.
No.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you can't just have a government coming and saying, look, give us what's yours. I mean, no way. I wonder, it's just been passed?
And you can explain the legal standard for getting a warrant versus getting a subpoena. So that's really...
So here in the U.S., the rule is, if they want to get my email from Google, and it's less than 180 days old, they need a warrant, and they need probable cause, permission from a judge, I must approve. If they want to know whether I emailed you, they need a lesser court order, lesser proof, but they still have to go to court to get an email on. To find out from Google what my, not from Google, find out from Verizon where I live, how I pay for my bill, they don't need to go to court at all. They just serve a subpoena on the provider.
Yeah, that's awkward. I mean, no, I know it is where we heard about the concept of subpoena, but no, it would not be imaginable. I mean, if my government wants to know my address, well, okay, first of all, we have a citizen's register, so they actually know where I live. But besides that, if they want to know if I did any sort of phone connection or whatever, of course they would need to go to court.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could add a little bit of clarification and context. I mean, okay, first of all, U.S. surveillance law breaks out into different categories, and I don't know that the same is true in all EU member states. So you have different standards that apply for interception of real-time communications than you would have for access to stored communications. So, you know, there have been a number of studies, including a study by a law firm called Hogan Lovells. There's a new paper out on the U.S. submission of the EU's website today talking about, among other things, the Patriot Act. And a lot of these studies that have concluded that, on the whole, the U.S. rules governing access to law enforcement compare favorably to the extent meaningful comparisons can be made to those of most EU member states. I think Greg is pointing out a particular problem where there's been a large group of civil society and industry, actually Google favors these changes too, to something called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And in fact, Google was in Strasbourg on Friday talking about their work with this Digital Due Process Coalition. So I think what Greg is alluding to is that there is a bill before Congress. The Obama administration has not taken a position on it, but that would seek to remedy what the Digital Due Process Coalition perceives to be a particular problem with access to stored data.
What Greg is asking is, what are the rules in Europe for access to stored content? Do you have to go to a judge and prove that the person is probably involved in crime or not?
Well, you definitely need a court order to do so. I mean, you can't just go and go to a provider and say...
It would not be the case in the UK. I mean, the UK would be worth looking at, but, you know...
Well, even they have... Okay, I mean, I can talk for Germany, but again, we have also a framework decision dealing with the access to data by judicial and police cooperation. Basically, I mean, it might be that, for example, in cases of immediate emergency or danger at, I don't know what the legal term in English would be, but the general rule is no public body can just go to a provider and say, give me what you have. I mean, even in terms of this terrible data retention directive, you need an order by the competent authority. I mean, you can't just go and take it. I mean, this would be different.
Right? Now, in fairness to the European Union, that in member states, the European Commission doesn't really have jurisdiction over some of the criminal laws in the member states. So generally, the member states make up their own different rules on
right.
criminal
law.
Right,
yeah, laws. I mean, I think that's why you'll find...
One has to distinguish. If we would call it, I don't know if you can, the legal term is right in English, material law. That is true. for example, the European Union cannot define what is a murder or what is fraud or something like that. But the procedural law we are working on, I mean, we do not have the official competence, but if you think about, for example, the Data Retention Directive, that designs under what circumstances and in conjunction with the framework decision on data protection by police and judicial cooperation, under what circumstances police and judicial what we call it, bodies, can access information. So we do have elements of the criminal procedural law, although the European treaties do not allow it, but where there's no, how do you say, plaintiff, there's no judge, and that is why it has been sort of, in a way, dealt with as much as we have, for example, other areas in criminal proceedings where we have European regulations on that one. But it's true, on material, we cannot define, again, what is a fraud, what is murder, or what is theft, or something like that. But we can tell under what circumstances judicial or law enforcement bodies have access to data that we can do.
One more question.
I wonder if you can give a schedule of the Data Protection Directive going forward.
Probably mid of January, we will see the publication of the report of the rapporteur. Mid of December, for all those who can speak German, he will publish it in German. On his website, he already announced. Let's see if that will happen. But again, the official version will be mid of January. Then, until the end of February, we have time to hand in amendments. The deadline for amendments is somewhere at the end of February. On the 24th or the 25th of April, the Civil Liberties, Justice and Home Affairs Committee, as lead committee, will vote on the amendments. And then probably June, July, we'll have the first reading in plenary. So it is likely, if everything goes by schedule, that before summer, at least we will have a position of the Parliament. If this matches the position of the Council, we will see. If that doesn't happen, after the summer recess, we will have to engage into a second reading. And so, most likely, if everything goes by plan, which is random rule works in politics, before the end of next year, we will have a regulation decided and, in effect, then 2 years later. But the short plan, and that's definitely not going to change, mid of January, the report, end of February, deadline for amendments, 24th or 25th of April, voting in committee, June or July, voting plenary.
So with that, let me just say that I personally feel much better that you're leading on privacy and security issues in Europe, and I wish you all don't get distracted by the budget issues. I know that they're pretty pressing. But
my other hat.
But I wanted to thank you for coming and just chatting with us. I appreciate it, and I hope to get you back maybe some other time, maybe in January, but maybe not.
Definitely. I mean, whenever, and then thank you very, very much for the invitation and also the challenging questions in some areas. I am sorry if I couldn't answer all satisfying, but if we just continue this dialogue, I think we basically learn a lot and actually also help Europeans to understand the U.S. a little bit more. It's not like we only have the feeling that we're not understood over here, but sometimes I think we could also understand the U.S. a little bit better. That would help us. So whenever you want to come over to Europe, just please feel free, feel invited, and why not, actually?
Okay, great. And your Twitter address is on our website, so if you want to follow Alexander, you're free to do that. Thanks so much for coming. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.